A warning, this episode talks about suicide and the aftermath of it. A lot. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. I say I'm glad you're here every week, in part because not everyone is here, and I wish they were. I make the show. I do all the work I do to enable open conversations so that more people we love can be here, so we can love them more. And sometimes that's a struggle. Struggle is all over that proposition of staying, of being here, of sticking around. For a lot of people, just staying alive takes so much work. It is so much struggle all the time. They are fighting a battle. And if they leave, there is permanent damage to everyone they left behind, which is a struggle as well, an ongoing struggle. Something especially hard about advocating positive mental health, pushing for more open conversations, is that I know I'm not going to win. We're not going to wipe out mental illness or stigma, no matter how hard I work. I can have every person in the world listening to my show every week. It wouldn't prevent all suicides. But I gotta keep going. I gotta fight and struggle, and I gotta get in there every day anyway. A lot of us have to. Ivan Maisel knows what I'm talking about. You might have seen Ivan on ESPN or in Sports Illustrated. He's been covering sports, mostly college football, for decades. In 2015, Ivan's son, Max Maisel, died by suicide. Max was 21. And Ivan has been talking about Max's life and death. He has a new book out called I Keep Trying to Catch His Eye, where he does exactly that. He talks about it. It's a remarkable book about life and death and love. It's about memory and grief and how you manage those very powerful forces. Ivan doesn't have all the answers, far from it, but he loves his son and he wants to talk. And I was very happy to talk with him. I've been rolling over this question a bunch of times, and I've read the book, so I sort of know the answer to it, but I mostly want to hear you answer it. Who was your son, Max?
Max was a quirky kid. The line I used about him when he was alive, and it still fits, is that, you know, I always thought that he was proof that God had a sense of humor. I grew up sports crazed. I have made my living writing about sports. I've traveled all over the world covering sports. Max couldn't give a shit about sports. Didn't care. Yeah, he liked to ski. He was a good snow skier, but he just didn't care. It just wasn't in his, you know, didn't mean anything to him. So, you know, I naively assumed when he, you know, as I thought about having a son, that that's who he would be. He'd be a little me. But I discovered that mothers have genes too. So he was not, but, you know, I built a bridge to him through humor. You know, I raised all our children on Looney Tunes and Marx Brothers and Max, especially on Bob and Ray. He developed an incredibly sharp, dry sense of humor that I thought did him a lot of good. Yeah, he was somewhere on the spectrum, so he had trouble connecting to people, but he could be funny, and that bought him some credibility.
It's interesting to me, despite the fact that I know you've written this book, and despite the fact that I know that you are out there talking about Max's life and death, even then I'm like, oh, would it be rude to ask him about Max? Like, there's an instinct in me that does that, even though you couldn't be more open about it. And, you know, and this show, if anywhere, is a place to talk about it. But to fill our listeners in on some of the details, how and when did he die?
Well, to your point, the great secret of people that lose children, especially children to suicide, is that we want to talk about them because it keeps them around, it keeps them present. I got a phone call in February of 2015, 25th, I live in New England, brutal winter, really just awful throughout the Northeast. And I got it. Max was a junior at RIT. He was 21 years and 1 month old. He had just gone back to school a couple of weeks before. Monday night, I'm fixing supper, phone rings. And the man says, is Margaret Murray there? My wife. No, how can I help you? He was a sheriff from the Monroe County, Rochester office, the sheriff's office. We found a car registered to her in the parking lot at Lake Ontario. Rochester borders Lake Ontario. The parking lot is a mile east of my wife Meg's brother's summer house. We went up there every summer with the kids. He knew that park like the back of his hand. He knew that lakefront like the back of his hand. Max did. And so as soon as the guy told me why he was calling, I knew what had happened, John. It was just the only logical explanation. He went up there. Max was a photographer. He was studying photography. He went up there to take photos. He went up there because he was comfortable. And that, you know, it was very easy for me to add up the two and two to a four I didn't want to get.
Yeah. You often hear the term shocked but not surprised, or shocked and surprised. Where did you fall on that when he passed?
That's an interesting question. I was definitely shocked because he had been home, and he was a shy, withdrawn guy normally. Yeah, he didn't, he had trouble with social cues, so it didn't come easily to him unless he warmed up to you. And he had been a little more withdrawn than usual during that winter break. We ascribed it to him just asserting independence, which was, in retrospect, of course, a spectacular misread. We were aware that he was being treated for depression. He had struggles throughout his life. So this, so the surprise, certainly not to the degree of the shock. But of course I was surprised. I mean, it was, he was careful to, in this case especially, not tell us, perhaps to protect us, we don't know, but to not tell us that he was struggling. Mm.
You say that talking about him keeps him close and keeps those memories there. And it's interesting how so often it can feel to the person grieving like they're responsible for making it okay for everybody else. People come around and they say, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, how are you doing? And I've talked with specialists in grief on these issues, and about this burden that the grieving party has to contextualize the death and normalize the world for everybody else, and how out of kilter that seems. What was that like when people started coming to you about it and looking to you for answers in your darkest hours?
That is a great question, and it gets to the crux of one of the biggest reasons I wrote the book. I mean, obviously I wrote the book because I didn't want Max to be defined by how he died. I wanted to define how he lived. But I was so bad at grief because I was scared of it. I've tried to live a pain-free existence. And to my detriment, I would always stiff-arm grief and stiff-arm people who were grieving, mostly because I was scared. So I had that vantage point of I knew why they were struggling. And that helped in terms, as you call it, contextualizing. At least I kind of knew where they were maybe a little better than I would have otherwise, because, that's where I had been. But my point is, I wanted to write the book to be, the phrase I used was to be a docent of grief, to inform them this is what this felt like and this is what how I was comforted, so that people won't be scared of it. and to try to help them understand, you know, this was my life. And it, you know, you have the struggle when you're discussing something like this, because people are so scared of it that they won't open themselves to it. And I was trying then, and I'm trying now to say, if you live long enough, you got to deal with grief. And let me tell you how this worked in my case, and maybe it will help you.
Yeah. And sometimes it's grief at the end of a long life and at the end of a long illness. And, you know, it's sometimes it's when you least expect it.
Yeah.
In reading the book, it seems like one of the first things you did was kind of make a plan for how you were going to see this event. You were going to see it as what it was, which was the culmination of a long illness that you hadn't seen the real severity of, that had been concealed, because that's how that particular illness works, but that you had a plan to identify the grief as love and move forward. Did that come to you in the moment, or did you have to research that and meditate in prayer, whatever you do on that?
It evolved over a period of the first few weeks. I mean, the first thing I had to realize, John, was that the grief wasn't going away. Edward Hirsch, who is a poet, wrote a wonderful poem about his late son, and he used the phrase, "Grief is a 50-pound bag of cement that you carry up a hill that never ends." And that really resonated with me, in the sense that I thought, okay, you have to get used to this, and you have to learn how to function with it. You know, my wife said, we don't deal in prepositions. No, this is not something you get through.
Over, around. Yeah.
Around, yeah. So, which I thought was brilliant. But as I thought about it and tried to figure out this pain I was in, it just occurred to me, I'm not quite this anal, but, you know, I like things that are even. And it just occurred to me that the amount of grief I was in was commensurate. The amount of pain I was in was commensurate to the amount of love I had for Max. Well, it's a very short distance from that. And I started thinking about that and just realizing that grief was the form that love takes for the the love you had for the person who died. That's the form it takes. And once I thought of that, and, you know, and the editor in me just took that unwieldy sentence I tried to explain and came up with, grief is love. Grief is love. And once I thought of that, it just resonated with me, and it made sense, and it just made the whole process, with the understanding that I had to get used to this, that it wasn't going anywhere, thinking of it as love just allowed me to exist with it and to let the pain wash over me rather than fight it.
So was that used, did you use that as a reminder when what I imagine were a lot of other feelings were coming up? Like, you must have wanted to scream. I don't know how you are with anger, the guilt of it all. Is grief is love, is that something that you were able to like return to like a mantra and kind of set yourself straight?
It was a good guidepost. You know, I didn't have a lot of anger. I had, you know, obviously I had some, but I understood he was sick, so it was hard to be angry with him. Everybody, you know, Max didn't let on that he had any suicidal ideation, either to the people treating him for depression or to us. So it, you know, it's hard to be angry at the professionals, you know, when they are looking for things that, you know, he didn't tell them about. It just helped me sort of understand that why I was in the pain I was in. And we had a neighbor who had lost her husband suddenly to a cardiac event. And she said to me, and I think it may have come from a greeting card, it sure sounds like it, but, you know, she said, standing at the water's edge, you know, the grief, sometimes the water washes over your ankles and sometimes it washes over your head. But in both cases, it recedes and goes back out. And that, with time, that I understood I would have a good moment and I would have a good hour and I would have a good day. So that when I had a bad day, I understood that it was temporary. And that allowed me to feel joy, to understand that just because this really bad thing happened did not mean that good things would stop happening. It was just, you know, my turn, you know, I won the lottery, the bad lottery.
Yeah. Yeah. You talked about not having a lot of experience with grief, at least, you know, at this level. Did you have a lot of understanding of depression, of suicidal ideation? Is that in your past or your family's past at all?
I've been treated for depression. I was treated for depression probably about 20 years ago. So I was not scared of that. And, you know, when we figured out Max needed to be treated for depression, I was fine with that. I understood the illness part. And yet, one of the things that I have regrets about is not confronting him about his depression. And confronting is a bad word. It's not really what I'm trying to say, but not talking to him about it. You know, I didn't want him, and this is the classic, you know, you talk about not wanting to bring him up. I didn't want him to think that I thought he was struggling or I thought that he might be suicidal. And not that I did think he was suicidal, but I didn't want him to think I was struggling, because I just tried to show him, and this was probably honestly chicken shit on my part, you know, that not wanting to confront that pain. I'm not a confrontational person. That should be painfully obvious by now, but I felt as if I just took the role with Max as cheerleader, that, you know, you're doing great. You're going to figure this out. Whenever you set your mind to do something, you do it. When I saw him, I made sure I had a smile on my face, that he knew I was happy to be around him. You know, that was probably, again, in retrospect, you know, the woulda, coulda, shouldas, you know, maybe not the right thing to do.
Well, I mean, you gave him a place of love to return to. It's one of the only things a parent can do.
That's a nice way to put it.
Ivan refers to RIT, and that's the Rochester Institute of Technology. More with Ivan Maisel in a moment. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. back with Ivan Maisel talking about the life and death of his son Max, who died by suicide in 2015. I asked Ivan how his guilt was doing.
I don't have a terrible amount of guilt. I know that, as you say, I operated out of love, and that he knew one of the last things that he said to my wife is that he knew we accepted him for who he was. And he told her that his last winter break at home. And that, that helped and sort of gave us the get out of jail free card on that subject. Meg, and let me make it clear, this is my story. This book is my story. It's not my wife's story and not my daughter's. Meg feels a lot more guilt as mothers are probably wont to do. I understood at some level, John, it's an illness, and I'm not a doctor. It's an insidious illness, and, we don't understand it because we can't see it. And so I don't think we ascribe its full fury that mental illness is capable of, because it's nothing you can really see in a lot of cases. But it's an illness, and he was sick, and maybe we could have gotten him better care earlier, but I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that.
Yeah. Suicide, unfortunately, happens a lot, and the numbers during COVID have dropped a little bit, but the rate of people reporting suicidal ideation is way up, which is ominous and frightening, and certainly something to think about and something to pay attention to. But a lot of these deaths are out there, but a lot of the people they happen to aren't skilled professional writers like you. Why did you write the book? Why did you not just say, I'm going to go deal with what happened with Max in my own way? Why have you gifted us this book? And it is a gift.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very nice. I think writers write, and the way I made sense of this early on, in the early days, is how I grieved. I would just open this laptop and just vomit into it, get it all out. And then on the first anniversary, well, let me back up. We had a memorial service for Max of 5 weeks after he disappeared. We didn't recover his body for 8 weeks, but before that, we went ahead and had a memorial service, and I wrote a eulogy and delivered it. There were nearly 1,000 people at the service, and a lot of people asked me for, that they wanted a copy of the eulogy. And so I just posted it on Medium. And then after a year, I've had some thoughts, and I put them in an essay, and I posted that on Medium. And then 3 years out, I did another essay, which I entitled the cover, the name of this book, I Keep Trying to Catch His Eye. And I posted that on Medium, and it went viral. And in that made me think, well, maybe there's a larger story to tell here about grief. And so I just sort of that planted the seed in my mind, and I just sort of let it germinate. And 5 years out, I had the perspective of time, and I went to lunch with a college friend of mine, and she nearly came across the table at me and said, when are you going to write about Max? And so I thought, okay, the universe is talking to me here, and the pandemic happened, so I had time. So it all worked out.
What happened to your grief in the process of writing a whole book about this? Because books are not easy to write, and they take a long time and a lot of work.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? This book was not therapeutic for me, John, and it was not cathartic for me. I feel like I had to get my legs under me before I could think clearly enough to shape a narrative. What the book did in some cases, I went back and read all of those grief things I, had put into my laptop, which were instructive as to where my head was at the time, and gave me a lot of good thoughts that I used in the book. But yeah, it dug up a little bit that I had compartmentalized, but not terribly so. I mean, One of the other things I figured out about this whole process, John, early on was that I couldn't stay with Max, that I had to keep living and I had to keep going, and that I could experience joy again. And if I didn't experience joy again, then Max's death would cheat me twice, cheat me doubly. You know, the fetal position was really comfortable, but you can't live in the fetal position. And
it's hard to type, for one thing.
Exactly. You know, we had a nephew that got married 2 weeks after Max's body surfaced in Lake Ontario. Did we want to go to the wedding? God, no. But the four of us, you know, Meg and our two daughters, talked about it. And, you know, I thought, well, if we don't go, then we get cheated again. And we cheat them. We cheat my nephew, my daughter's cousins, and we cheat the whole family because we're not there. Mm. So sort of fake it till you make it.
Yeah. Yeah. You have two daughters as well, and one older than Max, one younger. And I think about how when my brother died by suicide, my kids were very young. That I only had two of them at the time. I have three now, but they were 5 and 3 years old. And in many ways, it helped because I could just say, hey, this person who you knew was sick and was sicker than we realized, and he died of how sick he was, which was both true and consumable for very young children. Your kids were older, young adults practically. And
yes,
but it still must have felt like a father's job to teach, to inform, and to kind of frame this and guide them through it. How did you do that while trying to guide yourself through it and your wife?
I understood at some level that, you know, it's bad to lose a child. I would cringe at the idea of losing a sibling. And so I knew it, thinking about that made their pain real to me, that, you know, I couldn't be where they were. I couldn't understand what they were going through. And all we said to them, Meg and I said to our daughters, was, we don't care how you grieve, but you have to do something. Because if you don't control when you get it out of your system, then it will control when it gets out of your system. And that may not be convenient to your life at that moment. You know, when we had the memorial service, you know, I wrote my eulogy and I walked into each of their rooms and said, I need to practice this. Will you listen to it? And I really did that so they could hear what I was saying about Max, because I wanted them to know it was okay to tell stories about Max. It was okay to make fun of Max, as sisters do, as siblings do. We're telling people who he is. And all of us decided early on to be public about this. And I suppose the girls took their, took their cue from us on that. But being public just made a lot of sense to me on a number of levels. We didn't want people to interpret our silence as if we were ashamed of Max and the fact that he ended his life. And honestly, at that moment, when all you can do is put one foot in front of the other, I mean, I lost 8 pounds the week Max disappeared because I wasn't eating. The last thing I needed to think about was, you know, who had top secret clearance as to what really happened about Max. You know, were we going to end it at siblings? Where, you know, what do we do with second cousins? You know, they're friends, but how good of friends are they? And I thought, shit, I got enough to do. So I just said, put it all out there. And, you know, and Sarah, our oldest, was, you know, she's has a high emotional IQ. Elizabeth is our youngest and she's much more private, but we just encouraged them to grieve and to do whatever they needed to do. And they did it differently. They did it differently from one another, did it differently from me and Meg. So, but they, I feel like they're in a good place now.
Do you think that part of why I really like your book a lot, one of the reasons, is that it starts really with Max's death. Like that's one of the first things that happens right out of the gate. You make some soup and then you get a call. And I always think the people who make this decision, people who die, never get to know the wreckage left behind and the pain left behind, because they're in a place, you know. I interviewed Dick Cavett, who said, you think past, because he's been suicidal. He said, you think past this idea that there will be no me to feel better. You know, like the basic logic of, I can do this and cut the pain, but I won't realize the pain's ever been gone because the pain is so great. Do you think that suicides can be prevented if people just knew the damage to the people left behind that it'll do?
I think some could, but I don't think that they are in a position to comprehend that. I think, as you said, I think the pain is so acute that they just want it to stop. I have a woman I grew up with who I talk about in the book, named Robin Gerwich, who is a professor at Duke.
We've had her on the show.
Okay, well, Robin, you know, I've known Robin all my life.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
She is wonderful. And she called me the week Max disappeared. And I hadn't talked to her in 30 years. And we just started talking. And she made it clear to me, you will never understand why Max did what he did. You couldn't have stopped Max from doing what he did. You are thinking about this rationally, and he was not thinking rationally. And you will never be able to completely comprehend it. Because we're not built that way. And that, you know, look, that may just be a big jail, get out of jail free card on a lot of issues, but it made a lot of sense to me. And I know Max would be mortified at the amount of pain he caused, but he was not in any position to do anything about it by that, you know, by the end.
Yeah. I mean, it might be a get out of jail free card, but it might be that you don't belong in jail.
Bravo. That's really good. Yeah.
You know, maybe you've been unfairly sentenced, and it's a it's a good situation. What do you hope other people will get from reading this book?
Well, I certainly want them to know how Max lived rather than know him by how he died. You know, I'm in the media. I understand it. And another reason I didn't want to, that I wanted to be public is I didn't want to comment anybody, because I just think that's, you know, for a journalist to do that to me would be unforgivable. But to your larger question, I just wanted people to understand what grief, this kind of grief, felt like, and try to bring them on the inside of it. You know, the comment that you're living every parent's worst nightmare. And I finally said to a buddy of mine who's a good friend, I said, you know what? This is not a nightmare, because you wake up from nightmares. So I've got to, you know, I've deduced from that if I could explain this to people, you know, in a way that didn't scare them off because they are so scared of grief, that maybe when it happened to them or to someone they know, whether it's suicide or just grief, the death of a child or whatever, that they might handle it a little better than I used to, and than the way that some people handled it with us.
Were you surprised when you were writing the things that you put on Medium, or, you know, with the reception of this book? It seems like a lot of guys, especially in the kind of college football world, that is known to value a kind of traditional male toughness, perhaps. Yes. Some may call it toxic masculinity. Some may call it machismo.
Yeah.
Have you been surprised at the tenderness coming out of those worlds?
Yes. I mean, and look, you know, we are of the same generation, and I grew up in the South. So, you know, I got the full dose of John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, you know,
Bear
Suck
Bryant.
It Up, Son. Yeah. Bear Bryant. I grew up, you know, was my hero growing up.
Sure.
Might still be. But yeah, you figure out that's bullshit. You know, toughness is asking for help. Toughness is showing vulnerability. I think coaches in and the intercollegiate athletic industrial complex are much more open to that now over the last several years. You know, the death of Tyler Helinski, which I discuss in the book.
He's a quarterback from Washington State University.
Right. You know, and he died in January of 2018, and I wrote a story and did a piece on game day for ESPN about his parents. And his parents have done incredible work beginning a foundation that has created programs for athletic departments to use with their athletes. You know, the University of Nebraska, for instance, John, now has 5 full-time psychologists in the athletic department. And they are cognizant and they are trying to do their best. So there is more, and which is a very, I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but.
No, you're not.
The coaches did reach out to me and were much more solicitous of me than I expected. And I really appreciated that. And no, I could give you a list. But I kind of feel like on this issue, and both within athletics and society at large, that it's like climate change. We are cognizant of the problem and we are doing more than we've ever done. And yet the problems are metastasizing at a greater rate than we are prepared to deal with. And, you know, the more we shovel, the more it comes at us. So, which means, you know, we got to do a lot more and to get on top of this. And I think we will. You know, if you, I compared it to cancer in the way, you know, our parents' generation wouldn't speak of cancer in public, sotto voce, if at all. And I think, you know, we're getting there with mental illness, and that can only be to the good.
Yeah, I've compared it to littering and drunk driving too. Like the things where the whole society just rose up and said, you know, we might not solve this, but we can make it better than it is.
Yes, that's good. And it, those things were slow building, and then all of a sudden critical mass was achieved and boom, you know, and now, you know, everybody wears seatbelts, you know, and when we grew up, that wasn't the case. And now nobody even thinks about it.
Right. Yeah. People always say, well, we never wore bike helmets. I'm like, yeah, but we're the ones who survived. We're the ones.
Yeah.
Those other kids aren't around to say that. You've been covering college football since, like you said, 1987. I grew up not far from the University of Washington, so I kind of understand college football a little bit. I'll never understand it like the South understands it. And, you know, you're joining us now from Tuscaloosa.
Yes.
What has it meant kind of rejoining that world or you know, getting back into that work full-time, being in that zealous of a category of coverage where people are that far into it, knowing also that it's a game, you know, it's recreation and it's can be very silly at times. What has that meant for your grieving process? Is it a break from the grieving process? Is it part of it? How does that intersect?
John, are you saying that college football is not the most important thing?
I went to a small liberal arts college. We had a lacrosse team, but I don't really understand.
You know, it's funny. I talk a little bit about this in the book. I took this so seriously because I understand the passions of it. I grew up with it. I know why it's important, and it's why I've been able to tell the stories that I have told for so many years. But I was so close to it that I would panic at the big moments, the big games. You know, all I'm doing is writing about them. But they were just too big for me. After Max's death, I had a lot more perspective. You know, after Max's death, I understand as you said, heretically, may I add, you know, that they are just games. And I just trust my voice a lot more and I don't care as much. So what that gives me is perspective. You know, I can look at a game and say, okay, that's the best story to tell. write them and go. And I probably don't care as much because it's not as important as it used to be. And maybe that's not all bad. You know, it's a little freaky, John, to realize that your child's death made you a more empathetic person and made you better at your work. You know, if you focus on that a little too much, you can get queasy. But that's what happened to me, and that's how I had to change. And I'd much rather be the troglodyte I was if it meant he was here, but that's just not how it works.
Yeah. Be nice to have the wisdom without whatever earned you the wisdom, but that's not how it works. How is Max with you today?
Well, talking about him a lot helps as I have begun to talk about the book. And yet it also brings up more of the pain. The way I talk to him when I talk to him, and I don't do it as much as I used to, is just to tell him I'm sorry. And I wish if we had, we were doing all that we knew to do, and I wish we had been able to do what would have worked. I think a lot when I think about him, about who he would be now. And the great mystery of that is I have no idea, which is the sad part. He would be 27, almost 28 now. And that's a mystery we'll never have the answer to. And that's probably what gets me sad and chokes me up more than anything. It's just that we don't know and we never will. And you just talk about him and hope that people will continue to bring you stories about him that you don't know, because the stories you know, there are only a finite amount.
And I know I've heard this described by a lot of people, and I'm just wondering if you went through it too, is when you started to have the moments when you laughed, when you were happy, when you were truly joyful after he was gone, did you feel guilty about having those moments?
I did initially. Yeah, sure. But time does a wonderful job that way and realizes, how do you develop scar tissue? It only develops with time. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, I had to make a decision that I was going to continue to experience joy, that I was not going to cheat myself doubly. And once I, as sad as it made me feel to realize I couldn't stay where he was, it wouldn't do me any good. If I thought it would do me some good, I may have given it a little more thought, but I knew it wouldn't, that I just had to keep going. And once you make that decision and you pick up your bag of cement and go, then good things are going to happen and you have to be open to them.
Yeah. Ivan Maisel, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing the book, and thanks for introducing the world to Max. I feel better having known him.
Well, that means so much, John, and I'm such an admirer of yours. I'm really thrilled to be here.
That's Ivan Maisel. His book, I Keep Trying to Catch His Eye, is extremely well written, sometimes sad, sometimes funny. It's a good book to read if you know someone who has gone through something like Ivan has and you don't know what to say to them. Now, okay, episodes like this of our show are pretty heavy. I get that. But I think if you can face some of these terrible things, these terrible ideas and events, and hear about them and learn about them, you can make them not as scary. Just as horrible, but not as frightening. It's the devil you know, right? Okay, stay right there. I got something for you right after this break. A little treat for your mind.
Hello, I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And we host Still Buffering, a cross-generational guide to the culture that made us.
Every week, we share media that made us who we are. Things like Archie Comics,
Sailor Moon,
and lots of Taylor Swift.
And now that Riley's an adult, it comes with 100% more butts.
And now I am totally comfortable with it.
So check out new episodes of Still Buffering every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
Butts, butts, butts. Join in, Riley. Butts, butts, butts,
butts, butts, butts, butts, butts, butts, butts, butts, butts.
You're in the theater. The lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she stand up to her? Oh, good God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? We never know when we'll see ourselves in a movie, but that search for recognition is exactly what we're going to talk about on the podcast Feeling Seen with me, Jordan Cruciola. Each episode, we'll bring in a guest to talk about the films that they see themselves in and also the ways that movies have fallen short. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun or wherever you find your podcasts.
Now let's take a little moment, a little meditation moment to kind of reset and something our brain. Laura House is with us. She's our meditation pal, co-host of the Tiny Victories podcast. I got kind of down a well there with my words to
We're going to re-something. Why put pressure on it? We're just going to re-something.
Let's re-something with Laura House.
Yeah.
And as always, there will be some silences in here. Don't be alarmed. There's nothing wrong with your phone playing this podcast. The silence is part of the point.
Okay, so this is sort of a little micro meditation to re-something, as John has explained. So just close your eyes, if you can do that safely, not driving. Close your eyes and then just notice your breath. You are breathing. So just notice. Nothing to change, nothing to fix, nothing to do. Just sit comfortably. Notice. And just let go of everything for a minute. Okay, go ahead and open your eyes slowly. Hoping you feel just that much better. Did you re-something your brain, John?
I re-somethinged a lot. I reread something. So.
Oh,
yeah.
Doubled up.
I'm very advanced. For more of Laura, check out laurahouse.com. Check out the Tiny Victories podcast that she hosts with Annabelle Gurwitch here on the Maximum Fun Network. Laura, thank you. I say that as I exhale. Oh, okay. Laura, thank you.
And you can do these little micro meditations through the day when you grab a minute or just feel like, oh, I'm about to have a big meeting or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, check out her website, check out her podcast, and check out your own breath, I should say. Thanks, Laura. Next time on Depression Mode, you know, I have spent many years talking to people with mental illness. I'll interview someone, a comedian, without depression or anxiety or anything wrong with them at all. Someone who is okay.
My life is good and I feel like I'm thriving, and these are things I'm coming to understand as I grow older and develop and mature. And it comes a lot from me being okay. And I think audiences have really responded to that. When people are asked about my comedy, they often say, he's okay.
That's comedian Josh Gondelman. He's fine. There's nothing wrong with his mental health. It's a fascinating interview, how these people live. Often strange, sometimes disquieting. Gary Gulman will be with me on the show, too. If people support our program through a small donation, we can keep being here together. If not, we can't. If you donate, you make Depression Mode happen, and thank you. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. You can find a level that works for you, MaximumFun.org/join. I wrote a book. Did you know that? I wrote a book. It's called The Hilarious World of Depression, and it's a memoir, my story, all about mental health, lots of jokes in it. A lot of people tell me it's helped them a ton with their mental health, and that makes me glad, because that's why I wrote it. It makes a great gift, but not a gift to give to me, because I have already read the book. The Hilarious World of Depression, sold where books are sold, because it's a book. Be sure to hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do it now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show. We're going to get those conversations going. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free, 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. You can reach us through our electric mail address, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe, because that's my name. I spell it with an H. Hello, credits listeners. When NASA's Skylab space station fell to Earth in 1979, it landed in an unpopulated area in Australia. The Australian government then fined the U.S. government $400 for littering. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Welcome aboard, Kevin. Our former senior producer, Laura Swisher, is still within Maximum Fun, and we love her, and she's going to help us still. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hey, so we always put a listener voice right here in the show, like this one.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Monterey, California, here to remind you that you are not the worst thing that you've ever done, and I love you just as you are.
Okay, that's called a sounder, and you can send in your own. We hope that you will. Just record it on the Voice Memo app on your smartphone. Say who you are and where you are. No last names or actual location necessary. Lies are fine. And a brief positive statement. Maybe you'll hear yourself one of these weeks. If you sent one in before, you can send another one in. It's okay. Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.